"We are blessed by your generosity," Berilip said, and she threw herself to the floor before Quenthel Bayenry. Quenthel ignored her and once more scanned the chamber, smiling as she saw the webs coming into being, the thousand little spiders working their magic.
"There is a chamber across the pit," Gromp informed her, and he led her gaze to the far end of the room.
"What is in there?" Quenthel demanded of Berilip. "The lever of magic," she answered. "It controls the water to feed the elementals to hold the primordial, so Ravel has told me."
"A simple lever?"
Quenthel asked, turning to Gromp.
"Simple to a dwarf of noble Delzoon blood, so Jarlaxle has told me," the archmage answered. "Impossible for any others."
"And such a dwarf might pull that lever to free the beast,"
Quenthel reasoned.
"Such was nearly the destruction of Gontalgrim," Gromp explained. "The volcano that alerted us to this place many years ago."
"But if a dwarf king found the hallowed forge under the control of the drow," Quenthel remarked.
Gromp led her down the way to stand opposite the chamber, then enacted a magical doorway, a dimensional warp that the two of them and Methil could step across.
"A simple lever,"
Quenthel said when they moved under a low archway into the antechamber.
"Let me complicate it, then," the archmage offered.
He moved back under the archway and began casting a powerful spell, calling to the water. When he came back into the antechamber, he led a large, flowing, humanoid construct created entirely of water.
"A proper guard against any and all who would come in here," Gromp explained. "Except, of course, those who wear the insignia of House Bayenry."
The matron mother nodded her appreciation. Gromp signed his fingers at his illithid companion, and the mind flayer's tentacles began to wave and waggle around.
"Mark it?"
Quenthel asked, having read his hand signal to Methil.
"When we decide to return here, would there be a better place to arrive?"
Gromp replied. And Quenthel understood then that the archmage and his mind flayer had just magically attuned to this particular room for purposes of teleportation, both magical and psionic. When that was finished, Gromp moved back under the archway and reconstructed his dimension door and followed Quenthel back to the ledge across the way.
"The Chapel of Cusor Lauren," she repeated to Berilip. "And that tunnel, I think, would suit well your matron as her private quarters."
"Yes, matron mother."
"Consecrate this ground with the blood of slaves," Quenthel instructed. "Feed the primordial beast with the flesh of our enemies."
"Yes, matron mother,"
Berilip eagerly replied. So eagerly, matron mother Quenthel thought. On impulse, Quenthel lifted her arms out wide, tilted her head back, and closed her eyes.
"Lift your scourge," she told Berilip.
"Matron mother,"
the priestess replied with a clear tremor in her voice.
"It is fitting that my blood is first to seal the chapel. Lift your scourge."
With trembling hands, Berilip complied. She didn't snap her snake-headed whip at the matron mother, but she didn't have to, for it was an instrument of Lady Loth's wrath, and the snakes understood their purpose here. They lashed and tore at Quenthel's skin, and she reveled in the glory of Lolf as her blood dripped to the stones. She began to twirl and to dance, and Berilip kept pace, her four serpents biting again and again. After many steps and much blood, it ended, and the matron mother cast a spell of healing to close her wounds, regain her strength, and neutralize the poison of Berilip's vipers. Then she took her own five-headed instrument from her belt. Now it was Berilip's turn to dance for the Spider Queen. Some time later, Quenthel, Gromp, and Methil left Berilip lying on the floor of the primordial chamber in a pool of her own blood. Dazed and disoriented, The priestess would surely die if she could not find the clarity to collect her thoughts and her powers enough to heal herself from the venom of Quenthel's vicious serpents. In that tragic event, the matron mother figured, it would be the will of Lolf, and Matron Xerath would have no one to blame but herself for raising such impotent daughters. Chapter 12. Nets and Webs. Artemis and Treri twisted and turned, trying to upright himself before his descent. He had no idea what had hit him and everyone around him, but only that they were all flying now, bounced a dozen feet into the air by the rolling ground. He came around and saw his opponent similarly reacting. He glanced at the globe of darkness behind him and to the side, and noted Brother Athafrenfir bouncing down, then lying still along the ground, beside the darkness globe now, and twisted around, having landed awkwardly. This fight was over. He had no chance. He might defeat this noble drow of House Beenri, but to what end? So he half-turned in his descent and landed with his legs already moving, sprinting back for the building down and to the right of the burning stonecutter's solace. He waved his heavy cloak out behind him as a shield against the hand crossbow bolts. He heard Tiago Beenri's protest. "Coward!" the drow cried. And Treri ignored him and sprinted around the edge of the building, sheathing his weapons as he went. He leaped and caught a handhold, and with exceptional strength and agility, spun himself up and over, throwing his legs above him and onto the low roof. He rolled over and came up in a crouch, and saw again Tiago Beenri floating in the air just beyond the roof's edge. With an evil grin, the drow banged his sword against that translucent shield and stepped onto the roof. He lifted his blade in salute, bidding Entreri to come on. The assassin glanced around, seeking an escape route. He could run, perhaps, moving to the lower sections of the city. Surely the pursuit would become distracted by the many other targets. Entreri shook the thoughts from his mind and focused instead on this one drow stalking him. With a shrug, he drew his weapons and charged. They came together in a blur of movement, turning and leaping out to either side, diving back in. Sword and shield met sword and dagger, blades ever turning and re-angling, particularly from Entreri, who took great care not to let either of his weapons become entangled again in the web-like properties of that strange shield. The combatants turned and rolled as readily as their weapons, each seeking an advantageous angle, for they were surely well-matched here. Other dark elves rose up as spectators, levitating around the roofline. Somehow that spurred Entreri on, and he began to drop his trailing foot back just a bit more with each riposte and each turn. He wanted a win now, even at the cost of his own life. So be it, he thought, as long as he could bring this one, this Beenri, down before him. But he was running out of time as Tiago's allies positioned around them, and as this young drow warrior, superbly skilled and trained, matched his every move. Entreri dropped his foot back just a bit more as he spun out to the left, coming around with a backhand that Tiago ably ducked. And in came Tiago, clearly understanding Entreri's desire to flee. The jeweled dagger flashed, taking aside the drow's sword thrust, but that thrust was merely a feint, Entreri realized. And he leaped up as the real attack, a sidelong slash of that shield, cut in at his knees. He went up in a turn, kicked out, but pulled short on the kick, his own feint, and let his leg fling out to the side as Tiago's sword vainly tried to catch up. And around went the leaping Entreri, and now his right leg came around instead in a circle kick, and the drow could not recover before getting Entreri's boot slammed into his face. Tiago staggered backward. "Oh, clever!" he yelled, his voice slurred as he spat blood. "Get used to it," Entreri growled and came on. He pulled up short, though, and twisted around to avoid a hand crossbow bolt, diving in over Tiago's right shoulder and flying for his face. A click from the other side had him turning fast back the other way, and the second dart skipped past. And in came Tiago with a shield rush, bullying toward him, and the drow sword flashed out beside the blocker. Entreri hit it with his own blade and stabbed in behind it and just over Tiago's shield with his deadly dagger.
The drow ducked the thrust and lifted his shield to lift Entreri's arm, and the assassin felt the buckler grabbing at him, pulling at his clothes with its web-like stickiness. So Entreri didn't fight it, and instead pressed ahead, pressed into the shield, and bulled into Tiago, driving him back and standing tall to drive him down. The bite of a hand crossbow dart got him in that leading left shoulder. A second grazed his face, and as he fell down atop Tiago in a heap, he saw the other dark elves moving for the roof to intervene. More than spectators, after all, he realized, and knew he was doomed. He tried for the kill, desperately wanting to see Tiago's last breath before he breathed his own. But even caught by the sudden reversal and the surprisingly aggressive move, the drow noble proved up to the task of defending, keeping Entreri's dagger arm stuck and up too high, and working his sword in tight against Entreri's at the proper angle to keep the blades out to the side. Entreri couldn't gain any leverage here, and he felt the drow noble wriggling out from under him, even as he felt the drow poison seeping into his body. Never in her experience had Dalia felt the sheer power and magical strength contained within Revelzor Lauren's lightning web. It floated down over her and her son, chasing her to the ground, it seemed, as she transformed back from her cloak's crow form. Immediately she drew forth her flail, slapping it together and straightening the hole in a single motion to have the fully reconstituted Kozah's needle in hand, and she prodded up the end of that staff to catch the center of the descending lightning web. "Fly away," she heard Efren cry to her, and there was great fear in his voice, she knew, and she understood as soon as her staff touched the drow Dwiamer. The energy of the gathered storm crackled within her, her hair flew wildly. The web descended, sparking and exploding, shaking the ground. Teeth chattering, unable to speak, Dalia tried to cry out to Efren to take her hand, hoping that somehow Kozah's needle would shield them both. She barely managed to glance his way out of the corner of her eye and saw that he was a charred thing already sinking to the ground. And the explosions roared on all around her, the ground shaking, like a prolonged peal of thunder reflecting back and forth off canyon walls and hardly dissipating. More energy flooded into the staff, arcing around its length, stinging her hands, reaching into her. She felt her heart pounding, her temples throbbed, the world seemed to go dark, black splotches racing across her vision. But she held on, because to let go was to be consumed, to melt as Efren had. Efren, her son. Rage drove her back against the mounting force, a scream of denial deep in her mind. She clenched her jaw tightly to stop from cracking her chattering teeth or biting off her own tongue. And then it was done. The lightning web folded up, swirling above her once more as it seemed to be sucked into the end of her mighty staff. She couldn't contain the power. She felt as if the metal staff would simply explode, or if it did not, as if the sheer power of the drow magic would consume her. She half turned, half fell, and in that movement saw Ambergris lying off to the side, propped on one elbow, staring at her dumbfounded. And had Dalia been able to see her reflection in the eyes of that dwarf, she would have understood, for she seemed more a creature of lightning than anything resembling an elf, with powerful arcs of magical energy streaming along her sides and limbs. And Dalia saw the female Drider staring back at her, lifting a club as if to throw it at her. Dalia threw first, desperately, Kozah's needle flying like a spear. It went in short, landing at the Drider's spidery legs, but it didn't matter. The blast launched the abomination into the air and sent a shock wave through the ground that made the street seem as malleable as a pool of water. Ambergris went flying, the porch of the building rolled and buckled, and then the building itself collapsed as the wave rolled under it. Dalia felt herself lifted into the air. She saw the Drider descending as she rose, legs curling under it, as if melting under the sheer heat of the blast, face locked in the mask of a dying scream. Out rolled the wave, up the hill to scatter the drow wizards and throw Entreri and Tiago into the air as they battled on the street before Stonecutter Solace. It rolled across the street to send Eurynome bouncing and screaming all the while for his beloved Flavar. Dalia came down awkwardly, twisting her ankles and knee, then falling hard to her face in the road.
She managed to prop herself up enough to see Ambergris sitting in the road, dazed and battered. And it was Amber's expression of sudden shock and terror that told Dahlia that the other Drider, the huge male, had come up behind her, an instant before she felt a blinding explosion around her head and went flying away into the darkness. The sheerest denial drove Artemis and Trary up on the rooftop, turning and twisting with Tiago Bayenri, stuck to the Drow Noble's shield, the wider world spun around. And in that panorama, Entreri saw Dahlia fall. The elf woman lay in the street before the towering Drider. Ambergris would fare no better, the assassin knew in that instant. The dwarf sat there, clearly dazed, the monstrous abomination closing in. And so denial and anger drove Entreri. He managed to plant his feet and regain a measure of balance, and with a defiant roar he rose quickly, taking Tiago with him, and spun around powerfully, throwing the drow aside. The stubborn shield let him go then, and he staggered behind the falling Tiago. But he caught himself quickly in reverse direction, sprinting for the far end of the rooftop. Another dart hit him, then another, then a barrage, sticking him and stinging him and filling him with poison. His arms felt heavy, his vision and other senses suddenly dull, and he knew the drow noble would be close behind. He dived down to the edge of the rooftop, or perhaps he fell, for his legs grew numb beneath him. He reached over, making as if to pull himself forward to drop to the ground. But that wasn't the point. He hadn't run off with any thought of escaping, because he knew that he couldn't possibly escape. But his dagger could. He reached under the eaves of the roof, hooking his arm down and around, and tucked his dagger neatly in place, and then he did pull himself over and simply let go, crashing down to the ground. He rose stubbornly and staggered away, cutting between other buildings, around corners, the drow's taunting laughter following him every step. Finally, thinking that he had done enough to throw them off the track of his prized weapon, Entreri stopped and turned to face the pursuit of Tiago Bayenri. The assassin was falling into darkness before the drow noble even caught up to him, the drow poison taking his strength and sensibilities. He heard Tiago Bayenri call to him, by name, and that seemed a curious thing, a ridiculous thing, but he couldn't quite figure out why. Dahlia felt the heat all around her, and the constant ring of metal on metal. She sensed that she was standing, but she couldn't be certain. And she couldn't understand how that might be in any case, for she had no strength in her legs. She felt something pressing against her cheek, like the flat of a sword blade, perhaps. The elf woman opened her eyes and recognized the place at once, or at least realized that she knew this place, though she couldn't quite sort it out. She remembered the explosion in the street, Kozah's needle releasing a tremendous burst of magical lightning. She saw again the Drider female, curling up in charred death. She winced as she remembered the explosion in her own head, then wailed loudly as she thought of Ephron, her son melting beside her. She had tried to save him, but to no avail. "Welcome back," she heard, a familiar voice that brought Dahlia more fully into the present and the scene around her. Never lifting her cheek from the metal strap on which it rested, she glanced to the side at the speaker, Artemis Entreri. He was hanging in a metal cage, almost a coffin of banded straps, it seemed, pressing him tightly, holding him upright. As was Dahlia's own cage. "Caught again," she heard Entreri say, his voice hopeless and helpless, too far removed from caring to express any real concern. They were in Gontalgrim, Dahlia realized, in the forge itself. Strung up just a few feet from the floor. Goblin slaves moved around the various forges, carting wheelbarrows of scrap metal, carrying solid bars yet to be worked, while drow craftsmen stood by the trays and anvils, going about their work. Dahlia tried to turn to face Entreri, but so tightly was she held in the cage that she really couldn't manage it. Her effort did cause the cage to swing and rotate just a bit, though, and before it turned back, she noted a third cage in the line, beyond Entreri's. "Ephron," she whispered, hoping against reality. "Afafrenfir," Entreri corrected. "Though I expect that he's already long dead. He hasn't moved or made a sound in the hours I've been awake.
They brought him here,
Dahlia argued.
To torment us, no doubt, said Entreri. And he finished with a grunt when a drow moved up behind his hanging cage and prodded him with a hot poker shoved between the slats. That same drow walked over to Dahlia's prison as well and very casually laid the poker against her ankle. How she screamed! And none in the room, not goblin or drow, seemed to care. When the pain had ended, she glanced back at Entreri and managed to swing her cage once more. He just shook his head. He had been in a situation akin to this before, Dahlia recalled, a prisoner of the drow in their dark city of Menzo Baranzon. He had told her some of the tale, and had hinted at parts far worse. He had told her that he would rather be dead than fall into the clutches of the dark elves ever again. Dahlia could only wince as she considered that ominous warning, for she was an elf, the ultimate enemy of the drow. She would be tortured to death, she knew, and likely her torment would last for years. The four heads of Berylip Zorlaren's whip rose and struck at the form in the cage, biting deeply into the legs of the victim, tearing his skin, but alas, Afafrenfir did not stir. "Your friend is dead," Berylip announced to Entreri and Dahlia, walking over to stand where they both could see her. "He is the fortunate one." She looked up at Entreri and grinned wickedly. "Break in the earth," she said. "Do you have any more lies to add to your tale? It was they, these allies you falsely claimed, who informed us of your return." Entreri didn't answer. "We will learn where you have been these last 20 years, do not doubt," she said. "And then you will die. How that will happen is somewhat to your choosing. Tell me where Drizdo Erden is hiding."
"I don't know," Entreri answered. And he glanced to the side as a pair of male dark elves moved up to Afafrenfir's cage, one fumbling with a ring of keys as if to remove the corpse. The Zorlaren High Priestess laughed at him.
"So be it," she said, then waved off the two male attendants. "Leave him! Let them bask in his stench to remind them that they too will soon begin to rot."
Berylip turned to Dahlia.
"Where are the rest of your companions?"
The elf woman steeled her gaze and tightened her jaw, and again the drow priestess laughed, mirthlessly and wickedly, taking pleasure in pain and nothing more. Berylip turned and motioned to an attendant, who rushed forward bearing a basket, which he handed to the priestess. Berylip upended it, and a blackened and misshapen head tumbled out to land on the floor. It didn't roll or bounce, but landed with a splat and seemed to flatten out a bit, liquid oozing from it.
"Your son, I believe," Berylip said, and despite her determination to give these wretched creatures no satisfaction, Dahlia screamed.
She could not believe how badly it hurt, seeing this child she had long thought dead by her own hands, now truly dead before her. And so she cried, and she hated the world all the more. And the many drow in the forge paused in their work to laugh at her. The forges did not go quiet, and when the drow craftsmen tired, other dark elves replaced them at their work. Artemis and Treri hung there, half conscious, half asleep, exhausted and hungry, as the hours slid past. He was long past being bothered by the heat or by anything. The drow going about their business, the goblins running to and fro, none of it meant anything to him any longer. In the cage to his left, Afafrenfir hung limply. To Entreri's right, Dahlia cried, softly now as exhaustion stole her volume. That sound alone truly hurt him. He could accept his own fate. He figured he'd find a way to die soon enough, and so be it. But for some reason he hadn't yet figured out, Dahlia's fate touched him profoundly and painfully. He wanted to go to her. He wanted to hug her and talk her through this newest violation. He wanted to get out of his cage if for no better reason than to dispose of that blackened, misshapen skull, to get it out of Dahlia's sight, to bring her some relief, perhaps, from the agony. Many times did he reach out for the elf woman, his hand almost getting to touch her when she one time reached back. But clever were the drow, of course, experts in torturing and imparting hopelessness. Their fingers could almost touch. Her sobs whispered in his ear and echoed in his heart. Jarlaxle had done this, he believed. Berylip had mentioned Bregan de Earth. Jarlaxle had once again sacrificed Entreri for his own gain. But it made no sense to Entreri. Jarlaxle had rescued him from the curse of the Medusa in the Shadowfell. To what end, then? That and this? He cursed the drow mercenary under his breath anyway and glanced back at Dahlia. All that he wanted was to go to her and try to help. His feelings, so foreign, surprised him. Chapter 13. The Cold Night Fog.
I haven't even asked how you feel, Caddybree said to Drizzt.
They sat on some rocks at the edge of their encampment on a starlit night, the southern breeze warm for the season. About?
All of it, the woman said. The turn of events, the return of...
How could I be anything but thrilled? Drizzt asked, and he took his wife's hand.
But surely it is overwhelming. Have you even come to the point where any of this seems real?
Drizzt gave a helpless little laugh. Perhaps I am too busy basking in the joy of it all to care. I admit that there have been some fears. Didn't Wolfgart tell us tales of grand deception along these same lines during his captivity with Ertu?
Is it all just a dream, then? Caddybree asked. A grand deception?
No, Drizzt answered without hesitation. Or if it is, I don't care. He looked over at Caddybree to see her leaning back from him, her expression curious. Perception is reality, Drizzt explained. My reality now is joyous, a welcome reprieve. He laughed again and leaned in to kiss the woman.
So it is real, Caddybree agreed. But is it truly joyous to you?
Do you doubt my love?
No, of course not. But how overwhelming this must be. For the rest of us, returning was a choice, and for me and Regis particularly. Our lives did not move on from that night in Mithril Hall, when Mialiki took us away to heal our broken minds. The movement of time for us has been insignificant compared to the century of life without us that you have known. And even through the last two decades, we walked in our new life with the single purpose of rejoining as the companions of the Hall. We knew what to expect. Indeed, we strove for exactly this. But for you, it is a surprise. A dramatic bend in a road.
A most welcome surprise any person has ever known, no doubt, said Drizzt.
Are you sure?
He put his arm around her and pulled her back in close, side against side. I have spent a century missing all of you, but you most of all.
That pains me, she said quietly.
But Drizzt dismissed it with a determined shake of his head. No, he told her. No. Your memory was sustenance, and surely no burden. He gave a little chuckle and kissed her on the cheek to preface his next comment. I tried to forget you.
You make me feel so loved, he teased.
Truly, he said in all seriousness. When I battled orcs beside Inovendil, when I thought you, all of you, were dead, her counsel to me was straightforward. Live your life in the shorter spans of time of human lifetimes, she told me. To be an elf is to know and accept loss. And so I tried. And so, to this day, I failed. I tried to forget you. And yet I could not. You were there with me every day. I blocked you out and denied you. But alas, he paused and kissed her again. I have known another lover, but I have not known love again. Perhaps it was me, Aliki, reaching into my heart and whispering to me that you would return to me. You don't believe that. No, I don't, he admitted. What then? Perhaps we two were just fortunate to truly find love and a bond that outlived our mortal bodies. Fortunate or cursed? Caterbury asked with a wry grin. Were you not lonely?
No,
Drizzt answered, again with surety and no hesitation. I was lonely only when I denied you. I was lonely when I was with Dahlia, who I could not, could never love. I was never lonely when the ghost of Caterbury walked beside me, and the smiles I have known over the last century have ever been in connection with you. He glanced back over his shoulder to look where Wulfgar Regis and Brunner were exchanging tales of their adventures of the last 2 decades. Drizzt's expression grew curious when Wulfgar set a bucket of water down in front of the halfling, who shoved his head into it. Or in connection with them, Drizzt added with a smirk. Caterbury squeezed his hand tightly.
There is something strange with Regis, she said.
Something that should concern us.
No, nothing like that. He had told me that he is as comfortable in the water as in the air, almost. Watch. He will keep his head in the water in the pail for a very long time, longer than the rest of us could hold our breaths if we followed one after the other into a second pail beside him.
Drizzt did watch. Regis kept his head submerged, but kept snapping his fingers, as if to keep time, perhaps, or just to let the others know that he was all right. Drizzt looked at Brunner, standing over the halfling with hands on hips. The dwarf glanced back at Drizzt and shook his head in disbelief. Many more heartbeats passed, and still Regis remained underwater, snapping his fingers seemingly without a care.
"Ain't right," Brunner said. "Was his father a fish?"
Wulfgar asked.
"His mother, so he said." "A fish?" "Not a fish, but some ancestor. Again sea or something like that."
After what seemed an eternity, Regis finally surfaced and came up with a smile, hardly gasping or distressed.
"Gnasi,"
Caterbury said quietly to Drizzt as they turned back to the open night sky and the rolling terrain of the crags before them.
"He has Gnasi blood, so he believes."
"I don't even know what that means."
"Planet touched,"
Caterbury explained.
"Gnasi are genies of varying elements, and rumored to reproduce with humans. I have never heard of a Gnasi halfling offspring, but it is possible."
Of the 5 of us, Regis seems the most profoundly changed, and not just physically, Drizzt said.
"Perhaps. Not as many years have passed for us as for you, but we have all been touched profoundly, do not doubt. But doubt neither that he is Regis, the same halfling you once knew and loved."
"I speak of changes in outlook, and perhaps purpose, but not in character. Not so much."
"Is that your confidence or your hope?"
"Both,"
Drizzt exclaimed, and they both laughed.
"We've passed through death itself," said Caterbury.
as if that would explain everything. Drizzt leaned back and put on a more serious expression.
I would think that such an experience would make you more averse to the possibility.
Possibility?
Of death again. But you, all four, walk willingly into danger. We are chasing a vampire, and in a very dark place.
And then to war, it would seem, and yes, willingly.
Happily? Happily to your death?
No, of course not. Happily to adventure and to whatever awaits us.
A cold chill came over them then, as if the wind had shifted to blow down from the snow-capped mountains in the north. And Catti Bree pulled Drizzt closer and shivered just a bit. A fog came up before them, and Drizzt looked at it curiously. The weather shift seemed abrupt indeed. How much warmth had simply fled the air? But there was no snow and no water that he knew of, so what had brought the fog? The cold fog, he realized as it drifted closer. The cold, dead fog.
"Always got a tail, don't ye, Rumblebelly?" Brunner said with a laugh when the halfling finally resurfaced from the water bucket. "Can't ever be nothing regular about ye, eh?"
"I live to entertain,"
the halfling said with a polite and exaggerated bow, and as he rose he shook his head vigorously, drying himself as a dog might and splashing Brunner in the process.
"Brr," he said as he did, feeling a bit chilly and attributing it to the bucket of water.
But Wolfgar too stood up and rubbed his bare arms and took a deep breath, a breath that showed in the air.
"Getting cold," Brunner agreed.
Regis started to answer, but when he looked at the dwarf, or rather, looked past the dwarf, the words caught in his throat. He saw the fog. He knew this particular fog.
"What other tales ye got to entertain us then, Rumblebelly?"
Brunner asked with a wide smile.
"Part fish, part bird. Can ye fly too?"
Oh, Regis did indeed have a tale for him, but the halfling wasn't confident that Brunner would find it entertaining. And Regis wished he was a bird, truly, that he could fly far, far away.
"Run,"
he said, his voice barely more than a whisper.
"Oh, run."
"Eh?"
Brunner asked, not catching on. Regis continued to look past the dwarf, and he shook his head slowly in denial as the fog behind the dwarf began to coalesce and take the distinctive form of a tall, emaciated man.
"Oh, run!" Regis cried out, falling back a step. "Brunner, behind you!"
Wolfgar rushed past the halfling, between Regis and Brunner, roaring to his god.
"Tempest!" he cried, and he pulled Aegis Fang over his shoulder and let fly the warhammer in one motion.
The missile spun right over the dwarf's head, for the barbarian had used the horn on one side of Brunner's helmet and the horn stub on the other to line up his throw.
"Hey now!" Brunner shouted in surprise, diving down.
He came up and looked back just in time to see the hammer slam into the leering humanoid figure moving toward him through a ghostly fog. That fog intensified, as if flying out of the creature itself when the warhammer hit. If the creature had felt that hit at all, it didn't show it. It was as if it had become something less than substantial to accept the blow, the warhammer powering right through it, hardly slowly. The fog coalesced once more, the creature reforming as soon as the threat had passed.
"Rumblebelly, what do ye know?"
Brunner asked, backstepping toward the other two and veering to the side, where his axe rested against a stone.
"Ebon's soul,"
Regis stammered.
"The lich."
The horrid creature drifted in, eyes shining with inner demonic fire. Its emaciated, rotting face twisted and turned, shape-shifting it seemed. Wolfgar's hammer returned to his grasp. Brunner grabbed up his axe and ran beside the man. Regis inched forward on the other side of Wolfgar, and all three stared, gawking at Ebon's soul, all three unable to break the trance. All three horrified and transfixed. This was the power of the mighty lich. It went beyond the normal, gruesome realm one might expect from an undead monstrosity. Ebensole's terror transcended garishness and focused to the deepest fears of any mortal creature, to the most primal fear of death. In the lich's rotting face, an onlooker saw himself, undeniably so. To gaze upon Ebensole was to peer into your own grave, to see your own inevitably rotting corpse, to see the worms burrowing into your eyes, wriggled into your brain. That was the horror. Regis could only think of poor Pericolo Topolino, sitting in his chair, scared quite literally to death. He recalled how the grandfather's hair had turned white from terror. The aging halfling had looked beyond the grave, and like any mortal creature, had not relished the image and the implications. Regis could truly understand now the formidable weapon of Ebensole. He could understand the power of it, but understood too that he was not nearly as susceptible to it as Pericolo had been. Nor were his companions, for like him, Brunner and Wolfgar had already passed through death. Brunner had even looked upon his own rotted corpse in a cairn in Gauntlegrim, as Regis knew that his former body lay rotting under rocks in Mithril Hall, and Wolfgar's bones lay windblown on the tundra of Icewind Dale.
"Come on, then, ye rotten beastie!" Brunner taunted,
and Wolfgar slapped the returned Aegis Fang across his open palm. Ebensole stopped and stood up straight and tall, his thin arms lifting out to his sides, sleeves drooping wide to the ground, and crackles of lightning showing around his skeletal fingers.
"He's got tricks!" Regis yelled.
Brunner leaped forward, and Wolfgar lifted his warhammer to throw again, but both stopped as a black form flew in from the left side, crashing into the lich. Again the fog exploded from the undead monster, but not enough this time, and Guinevere's pounce, of course it was Guinevere, drove Ebensole hard to the side. From the darkness behind came Drizzt, weapons in hand, pressing hard on the creature. But Ebensole was gone then, just an intangible fog, and it swept as if driven by a hurricane in a sudden burst that landed the lich right beside Wolfgar. The barbarian and both flanking him cried out in surprise as Ebensole instantly reconstituted, his bony hand sweeping in to slap at Wolfgar. Lightning crackled as the blow connected, and the barbarian was flying then, lifted from the ground and thrown over Regis. He landed right at the edge of the encampment and pitched over a log he had earlier placed across two stones as a bench seat. A cross swept Brunner's axe in response, but the lich was fog once more, and Brunner overbalanced and stumbled forward when he hit nothing tangible. And then Brunner went down hard as Guinevere flew in through the fog and collided with him. Regis saw the incorporeal lich coming for him. He called upon his ring, warp-stepping just as Ebensole reformed, and now it was the lich's swing that hit nothing but air, and with the halfling turning around behind him to stab Ebensole with his own dagger. The halfling felt the press for a bit and knew he had stung the creature at least, but that solidity melted quickly, as did Ebensole. Now the fog blew away to the halfling's left, across the camp for the charging drow. Regis called out a warning, but Drizzt was already moving in any case. The drow ranger leaped into the air in a great spin, scimitars flashing out left and right, front and back, and repeatedly in a wild blur. Ebensole came back to corporeal form before the drow, and those scimitars dug in, slashing repeatedly at reaching arms and at the roped torso. But the lich accepted the blows in exchange for his own, an open hand that slammed into Drizzt and staggered him backward, and it was all the clearly dazed drow could do to hang on to his blades. He recovered quickly and fell into a defensive posture as the lich advanced. And Drizzt dived, rolling as far aside as he could, as a ball of fire appeared in the air above the undead beast, erupting into a line of fire that raced down hungrily upon the lich. Again, Ebensole became a fog cloud, reforming almost immediately just to the side and spinning around. Wisps of smoke rose from the creature's robes as it turned toward Regis and Brunner and toward Wolfgar, who was coming back into the firelight, staggering somewhat but ready once more for battle. A forked lightning bolt reached out at the trio, and they scrambled and dived, cried out in stinging pain, and spun down to the ground.
Through the blinding flash came Gwenivar once again. From the side came another barrage of magic, arcane this time, as magical missiles swarmed into the firelight and stung at Ebensole. Only then did the Lich seem to realize the presence of a sixth companion, a robed woman standing off in the darkness to the side of the encampment. Ebensole melted to fog and rushed away from the springing panther, and Gwenivar burst through the insubstantial curtain and landed far beyond the spot, digging in her claws and chewing up the ground as she tried to quickly turn around.
"Me girl!" Brunner yelled in warning.
Catti Bree knew Ebensole was coming. She called to her goddess and brought forth a brilliant light all around her, then saw the incoming rush of fog and lifted her hands to meet it, thumbs touching, fingers fanned horizontally, greeting the reforming Ebensole with a fan of flames. But the Lich hissed through the magical fire and swatted Catti Bree aside, sending her into a roll. She came around with a spell on her lips, but was relieved when Wulfgar's hammer took Ebensole on the side of the head, staggering him. The huge barbarian charged in behind the throw, Brunner and Regis close behind, and on came Drizzt from across the camp, blades rolling eagerly. Ebensole was fog, then reformed, and Wulfgar went flying even as he caught his returned hammer. Then to fog again went the Lich, in a frenzy now, becoming corporeal in front of Regis, and dematerializing almost immediately as the halfling dived away and Brunner turned in. Lightning crackled around Catti Bree's fingers, but she didn't dare let loose the stroke of magic, for the Lich was all around, near one companion, then another. She thought she had a shot, but Ebensole swirled into fog once more and swept around a startled Brunner, becoming solid behind the dwarf. Brunner grunted and rushed at Catti Bree as a clawed hand raked his back and a thrust open hand crunched into the back of his neck and sent him flying forward and to the ground. Catti Bree dismissed her spell, the crackling lightning dissipating around her. She searched her thoughts and recounted her spells and focused her attention at last upon a ring on her finger. Drizzt came at the Lich, blade swirling, but faster still was Ebensole, just a fog again, then reforming out to the side. Drizzt turned to pursue, but found a stroke of black lightning instead, slamming him in the chest and throwing him backward, eating at his very life force. He still watched Ebensole, the Lich becoming fog, the fog exploding all around as Gwenivar leaped through harmlessly. Back and forth went the fog, darting all around the encampment, the Lich reforming and striking, going away once more to strike again at a different target. The four friends and Gwenivar tried to formulate some defensive posture, but Regis went flying, and then Wulfgar grunted and was driven to his knees, and Gwenivar roared in frustration again and again, always a heartbeat too late to the spot to rake at the undead monster. And the companions were taking serious hits now, bruised and battered and bloody, and their occasional hits on the frenzied Lich seemed to show little effect.
"Elf, take me left," Brunner ordered, right as Ebensole appeared behind him and whacked him across the head as he tried to turn, staggering him to the side.
Drizzt rushed in, magical anklet speeding him, but he had to turn aside, indeed dive aside, to avoid getting swatted by an outraged Wulfgar, who swung mightily at the Lich. But alas, Ebensole was already gone. They couldn't match the speed and power of this one, Drizzt knew. They all knew it, and it seemed more likely that they'd inadvertently kill each other before ever landing any solid blows on the monster. Out in the darkness, Drizzt heard Catti Bree chanting in an arcane language he did not know.
"Scatter," Regis ordered. "We cannot beat him."
But Drizzt didn't run, and he went at the fog, meeting Ebensole as the Lich became corporeal, attacking furiously, if futilely, but determined to keep the creature occupied, determined to give Catti Bree the time she needed.
"Drizzt, no!"
he heard Regis cry out, and the words distorted in Drizzt's ears as he pitched through the air, swatted hard by Ebensole. The fog pursued. The Lich returned right in front of the flight of Wulfgar's hammer, a desperate throw that would only narrowly miss Drizzt. Gwenivar soared in beside Aegis Fang, but again Ebensole became fog, hammer and panther flying through, and the fog rushed for Regis then, and the blood drained from the halfling's face as Ebensole came up fearlessly before him, and surely the halfling saw his doom in the monster's fiery eyes. He stabbed out with his rapier desperately and repeatedly, and knew he was doing little damage, his pointed blade barely digging in. Ebensoul ignored it, not even bothering to dematerialize, but instead determinedly reaching his clawed hands for the halfling thief.
"Come to me, little pirate,"
the lich said in a vocal tremor that shivered Regis's bones, and Regis nearly fainted away, and Drizzt cried out from far behind, and Brunner, still on his knees to the halfling's left, called out for his doomed halfling friend. As he swooned, Regis barely registered the distortion that came into Ebensoul's watery voice, and it took him heartbeats to realize the visual weirdness as well, as the lich's face seemed to elongate, as if it was being pulled backward like soft dough or Sword Coast taffy. Ebensoul reached for him, but the moving hands seemed to be getting no nearer. And the lich was pulled back and stretched. Ebensoul's expression became one of puzzlement, and the lich became a fog as if trying to escape. But the fog offered no escape, not this time, and it was pulled fast back the way it had come, rushing past the charging Wolfgar, past Drizzt, and out into the darkness. Silence fell over the camp. Guinevere paced warily, turning tight circles. The four friends looked to each other, at a loss.
"Me girl,"
Brunner at last breathed. And as if on cue, into the firelight walked Catty Bree, one hand clenched in a fist and held tight against her breast, her other hand up and out before her, holding aloft a large gemstone.
"What did you do?"
Drizzt asked.
"We could not beat it," Catty Bree answered in a whisper. "I had to."
"She caught it!"
Brunner howled, and he scrambled to his feet.
"In the gem! Oh, good girl!"
"Catty?"
Drizzt asked. She looked up at him, and seemed as if waking from a trance. She guided his gaze to the phylactery and nodded.
"That was the spell for Puent," Wolfgar interjected. "The spell the Harples put in the ring."
"What did ye do, girl?"
Brunner asked, suddenly near panic.
"Saved us, likely,"
Drizzt answered.
He turned to Catty Bree.
"But what now? Back to Longsaddle."
The woman considered the words for a long while, then shook her head.
"On our way," she answered. "The lich is caught, his soul trapped within the phylactery. Ebensoul will bother us no more."
"But you used the spell stored in the ring,"
Brunner and Regis said in unison.
"And I have a scroll from the Harples replicating the magic,"
Catty Bree answered.
"Ain't your prison full?"
asked Brunner.
"That spell is beyond you."
"So you said," Drizzt added.
"I have performed it once, through the ring," Catty Bree answered. "I will find the power again. And the phylactery, we will find another. Or we can go back if you choose. But didn't you say when we set the camp that we are close to Gontalgrim's entrance?"
"Aye, we'll make the rocky dell soon after sunrise,"
the dwarf confirmed. Catty Bree shrugged and looked to Drizzt, and the drow took the cue to glance at each of his companions.
"To Gontalgrim, then?"
he said.
"Though I fear we'll have to destroy our old friend Thibbledorf Puent where he resides, instead of bringing him forth to accept the resurrection and true and clean death dealt by a high priest."
By the time he had finished talking, Catty Bree stood before him, blue mist snaking out of her wide sleeves, and she reached out to him with healing magic, soothing the bruises and cuts inflicted by Ebensoul. She made her way around the four, casting warmth and healing. It was a night of uneasy sleep for all of them,
after that horrifying encounter. But they were out before the dawn anyway, and into the rocky dell soon after, as Brunner had predicted. With the sun still high in the sky, they entered the tunnels and began their descent into Gontalgrim. Chapter 14. So many moving parts. The Beanri entourage made its way through the tunnels of the Underdark, but not directly back to Menzo Berenzon as they had planned. On the Matron Mother's order, they moved out to the east, escorting to Sabarak on the first leg of his most important mission. The Matron Mother was not among the contingent when they set their daily camp, of course. Gronth had created an extra-dimensional mansion where the selected nobles of House Beanri could relax without threat. The Illithid went to that refuge as well, and to Sabarak, too, had been given a room of his own. He was too important now to risk.
"I would have thought you more agitated," Quenthal said to her brother Gronth, sitting with him beside a glowing wall of artwork, whose colors shifted through the spectrum in a most pleasing display. Gronth created this distraction each night to sit and enjoy a fine wine or brandy. This was no surprise to his sister. He did the same thing in Menzo Berenzon. But she was a bit surprised at how content he seemed and how peaceful the artwork appeared. The old wizard looked at her curiously.
"I am sure that the longer you intrude in my private quarters, the more agitated I will become," he replied, and lifted his snifter of brandy and toast. "As pleases you, of course."
"We will leave to Sabarak soon," Quenthal announced. "He will finish this journey alone."
"The sooner I am away from the ambitious and sniveling Zorlaren, the better."
"Then you are bothered," the Matron Mother said with a sly smile.
"Not in the least."
"Truly? Dear brother, does the coming rise into Sabarak's stature not evoke a bit of fear at least? Might it be time for a new archmage in the City of Spiders?"
"Replaced by a Zorlaren, whose family has departed Menzo Berenzon?" Gromp said rather incredulously.
"Would the elevation of to Sabarak not serve as a strong tie between Menzo Berenzon and the fledgling outpost the Zorlarens have created?"
Gromp laughed aloud. "Ah, dear Matron Mother," he said, shaking his head as if it should be obvious. "Why should I fear this movement of Lady Love? Do I not have more to gain than you, than any of the matriarchs? The Spider Queen seeks Mistra's realm, and of Lady Love's current ranks, that realm is better served by trained males and best served by me."
"Or by to Sabarak," Quenthal
snapped back, her clear agitation showing the old mage that his reasoning had crawled under her skin.
"The Illithid's tentacles will not find my brain," Gromp assured her. "Nor do I wish to cast this spell. It will not be Gromp channeling Lady Love under the open sky of the Silver Marches, and that, I assure you, is to Gromp's liking."
"We're loved to hear that."
"She surely will," Gromp interrupted. "I have just told it to her primary voice upon Toril, willingly."
"And you do not fear her wrath?"
The archmage shrugged and took another drink.
"I do as Lolf has instructed me. I do not try to hide from her, for what would be the point? She knew of my feelings toward you when you were Quenthal, when you were merely Quenthal."
"How you plotted with Manol and Fay, you mean?"
Matron Mother Quenthal retorted. The archmage merely shrugged and didn't even try to hide his smile.
"And Lolf did not approve," Gromp said, "because she had other plans for you, plans that I executed upon her command. I am a loyal servant, and please, for both our sakes, do not ever confuse my apparent lack of ambition with anything more than greater ambitions I concoct on my own."
"What does that even mean?"
"It means, Matron Mother,
that the Archmage of Menzo Berenzon is Gromf, who has outlived all of his contemporaries. Those who think me old and near dead will find the grave before me, do not doubt. And any who try to usurp me will need more than a single spell imparted through Elvidenvelp to do so, even if that spell is inspired by the Spider Queen.
The way he emphasized the illithid gave Matron Mother Quenthal pause. Methil is your creature, so you believe.
Prove me wrong.